You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston is one of America's oldest cities, and there is a lot of fascinating history, including a lot I bet you didn't know. So author Daniel Dane has a new 800-page book about it. It's called A History of Boston, and he argues that our roughly 400 years are made up of five watersheds. Daniel Dane is here in Studio 2. Dan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So there's a lot I want to talk about, but I got to step back. What would make you want to try to document 400 years of such an undertaking?
It was a huge undertaking. I don't think I would have dove into it and done the undertaking if I actually thought I was going to write a book to start with. But I actually had no intention of writing a book. If you can believe it, I started the effort just for my own personal edification. I was so interested in Boston history. My day job is as a real estate development lawyer representing real estate developers in Boston. And so when my clients make decisions about investing in Boston, if they want to, say, build a new building in Boston, you know, it's a 3 or 4 year project, and they're making a prediction that in the future when the building opens, that people are going to want to continue to live, work, play, study, visit Boston, this sort of period of what I call high urbanism that's lasted really the last 30 years. But growing up in Boston, I remember from the 1970s and 1980s that that was not the case, that Boston was probably best described as a basket case. In 1950 census, the population of Boston was 801,000 people. In 1980, when I was growing up, the population of Boston was 520,000 people. So the city had lost almost 300,000 people in three decades. And so what really interested me, sort of as an intellectual endeavor for my clients, was why was the city so successful today? Why was it such a failure through most of the 20th century? And I knew from studying history that in the 19th century, Boston was so successful and so many people wanted to be in Boston that we needed to use landfill to fill in, you know, the islands of East Boston.
Okay, so let me just pause you there. So we literally took mountains, stripped them, filled in swamps, and built on it so we'd have enough space for people to live.
Back Bay, South End, East Boston. South Boston was a peninsula off of Dorchester. The waterfront was built with fill from what used to be called the Tri-Mountain, which was Mount Vernon, Beacon Hill, and Pemberton Hill, were about twice as tall as Beacon Hill is today. And we cut off the top of the three hills, where we get the word Tremont, the name Tremont Street today, and filled in the waterfront. And
that so that continued. We could expand.
So that we could accommodate all the people coming to Boston.
Right. So that is one of the things that is striking. And listen, I thought I knew, right? In fact, there's so much of your source material in this book, Dan, that we've covered on this show, right? So, you know, whether it's Carrie Greenidge's work or it's stuff about Mel King or it's busing. And of course, we pulled all this sound. We may use it, we may not. But there's so much I thought I knew. But when you put it all in one place, and yes, I read the 800 pages, right? You put it all in one place, it is gobsmacking the way Boston's been up and it's been down and it's been up. And the crazy things we did. Like, Sam Adams actually organized violent mobs of people to scare the bejesus out of British officials to get them to back down. And he did it on purpose to kind of guerrilla organize the pre-revolution.
Yeah, Sam Adams was an incredible propagandist. So you take the Boston Tea Party, which we think of as, you know, no taxation without representation. Well, the Boston Tea Party had nothing to do with no taxation without representation. The Boston Tea Party was really a dispute between legal importers of tea and smugglers of tea, right? So it was strictly a business dispute between those, you know, and these were people who lived in Boston, right? There were importers who were legally bringing tea in and those who were illegally bringing tea in, and they had a dispute between, you know, legal importation and illegal importation. But Sam Adams, being the brilliant propagandist he was, turned it into something that the majority of people in Boston really cared so much about that they were able to, that they were organized to commit an act of tremendous civil disobedience. So he was really one of the most brilliant political propagandists in the history of the country.
All right. So then you decide to break the we're up and we're down and we're up and we're down in these five kind of big watersheds, right, of Boston history. I'm going to hit them really fast. So there's religious rebellion and Great Migration. That's sort of 1600s religious rebellion coming out of England, people coming here, which of course means the violent displacement of indigenous peoples who are already in New England. Then we have a revolution. We have the Industrial Revolution. And then the 20th century. Boston fails to reform its economy. and then rebirth and a transformation to an innovation economy.
That's right.
Those are our big five ones.
Those are the ones that I characterize.
Okay. And you basically have this hypothesis that when we're up, we're doing what right?
So it was good to try to organize it into a catchy phrase. And the catchy phrase I came up with was that city building is based on what I call the three Ds: density, diversity, and good urban design.
Which nobody who doesn't care about those things would like get. So respect it, but in everyday language, what does that mean?
Yeah. So if you look at what makes cities successful, successful cities are really based on the ability to innovate. Right. What Boston has done so well in the last 30 years is an innovation economy. What Boston didn't do well in the 20th century was to innovate. And what it did so well in the 19th century was constant innovation. And you can even think of the revolution itself as a period of great innovation of ideas. And so if you look at both the history of Boston, history of cities, and lots of social science research, the way to foster innovation is to create those spaces design, sort of good architecture, also called social infrastructure, create those spaces that will bring lots of people together, density, from diverse backgrounds, diversity, and then through bringing them together in these spaces, lots of people to exchange ideas. That's where both innovation happens, as well as the social science indicates that better decision making is based on those exchange of ideas.
Okay, so let's just hit a couple of examples. And what I'm going to do here is use examples that were in sort of the source material you use, but stuff we've also talked on here on the show before, so I can pull some sound for us. Okay, so you use stuff by historian Carrie Greenidge a lot. So here is Carrie Greenidge talking about William Monroe Trotter.
He was definitely a disruptor, is a great word. He was somebody who was constantly putting himself in places where the bureaucracy of activism at the time, he probably was not invited to be, and then would insert himself, and through that, really insert average people who had little connection to these arguments that are happening between organizations, get them to feel that the argument and the struggle was their own.
So he starts a newspaper. He's advancing the NAACP in Boston. He is disrupting racial hierarchies. He's kind of one of these innovators that you're talking about who creates quite a bit of change at the turn of the century in the city.
He does up until the 1930s, and it's one of the difficulties in sort of dividing the city up into neat periods of time, because I really trace the fall of the city to 1920.
Yeah.
1920 is when there's a massive national deflationary recession following the return of the GIs after World War I. What happens is that with the return of the GIs looking for work, there's deflation. As prices fall, consumers decide to hold off purchasing decisions until later, because if you could buy it for some price today, if you wait a month, you can get it for less. And so economic activity in the United States largely stops during this recession in 1920, and it hits the mills of New England, the backbone of the New England economy, harder than anywhere else. And the New England mill economy reacts by looking for lower priced labor, and they find that in the American South and overseas. And you see, wholesale closures of mills across New England in the 1920s. And the New England economy really did not replace the backbone of its economy really until the 1990s, after it lost manufacturing and industry as the basis for the economy. And it really, my thesis is they did that because the city really closed its eyes and closed its ears to new and innovative ideas.
So, one of the things that you do in tracking, and again, we're speaking with Daniel Dane. He's got a new book about the history of Boston. We're talking now 20th into the 21st century. One of the things that you do in that time, Dan, is you really sort of track our mayors, right? So you spend a lot of time. I sort of knew the history of James Michael Curley, his level of corruption. I didn't know how deep and long that ran. How many times he was accused of crime, the gaps in his time, the number of offices that he served in while he was sort of corrupt. But you sort of follow this trajectory, right? So Kevin White comes out of office. You talk about Mel King running. Now the office is open. You talk about him running against Ray Flynn.
1983.
So here's a little bit of Michael Curry back this past spring talking about the courage of Mel King running in that race.
How phenomenal for a man in the context of all of that to decide, I want to cross racial lines, neighborhood boundaries, and I want to run for mayor. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give hugs. And I'm going to talk to people in West Roxbury and in Roslindale and in Southie and in Roxbury and try to bridge the gaps and bring people together.
Chris, he was the first black man to run for mayor of Boston. He loses to Ray Flynn. But you then say that the turnaround really starts to happen with Tom Menino. You surprised me, though, by laying more of it at the feet of Marty Walsh than I would have expected.
Yeah, so what's so fascinating about urban renewal in the 1940s and 1950s, which was the process of using federal tax dollars to tear down dense, diverse neighborhoods and replace them with low density and undiverse neighborhoods, is just how unquestioned it was that Boston's economy was stagnating in the 40s and 50s. And so there was this notion of, if we want to keep people in the city, we need to tear down the neighborhoods that have given the city
vitality. They raised
vitality,
neighborhoods, R-A-Z-E-D.
Yeah.
So, and Mayor Wu has reversed that.
So total lack of objection when the New York streets were torn down. Mel King had grown up in the New York streets, which is where Ink Block is today. When the West End was torn down, it was a neighborhood without much political power. When Scully Square was torn down. And so the 1960s really starts with a period of, wait a second, is this really the way to save a city by tearing it down? And Mel King is a very important player in, you know, what is often called the People's Rebellion against some of the terrible tenets of urban policy in the 1950s and 1960s. And so you could really trace the beginning of the movement to save American cities to people like Mel King in the 1960s. Despite that, and despite tremendous work by social advocates throughout this period, Boston's population continues to decline. If you had to pick the worst decade in the city's history, 1970s would be a pretty good candidate in terms of what makes cities vital. And as I said, by 1980, the population of the city had fallen to 520,000 and didn't really grow much in the 1980s. And it's really not till the 1990s that the population starts turning around and people start coming back into the city. But it really takes off in terms of a new innovation-based economy under Marty Walsh.
All right. So last question for you. You've looked at 400 years of trajectory. As a betting man right now, given the challenges of housing, transit, et cetera, are we in an upswing or a downswing?
There's lots of reasons to be pessimistic about the history of the future of the city. I think that housing affordability, our transportation system, climate change, equity and diversity, remote work are major crises that are facing the city today. But I don't think we're going to go back to where we were in the 20th century of really a rejection of cities. There's too much. The companies of Boston are too invested in the notion of, in order to innovate, they need to be in these ecosystems where you bring lots of people together from diverse backgrounds. And I think that gives me confidence that cities will remain vital. But unless we solve these crises that are facing us, which are really, really difficult crises to face, and I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the challenges of solving them, it's going to be difficult for people to afford to live here. And companies, I think, will react by locating in other places where they can pay their employees less money, but it will go further because the cost of living is lower.
All right. Author Daniel Dane, the new book is A History of Boston. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. That was really fun.